I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Another 60 Iraqis are dead this morning, all victims in one more wave of car bombs and suicide attacks across the country. The bombs exploded in recruiting centers and markets and near police stations in places like Kirkuk and Tikrit and Baghdad. Now, this brings to over 400 the number of those killed just in the last couple of weeks. At the same time, the U.S. military says it's turning more of its attention to foreign fighters in Iraq, hoping to choke off those coming in from neighboring states like Syria and Jordan and Saudi Arabia. This hour, we're going to find out what we can about the identity of the insurgents. Who are these people? And why are they so determined to kill so many Iraqis day after day? Are they simply trying to make a mockery of American attempts to bring peace? Or are these the first attacks in an Iraqi sectarian war pitting Sunni fighters against the Shiite majority? Well, we'd like to hear from you on this program as well. What does it mean for U.S. policy? Should this country be cracking down harder on states like Saudi Arabia if it can be proven that people there are funneling money and fighters to the insurgents? And what about Syria? What about Jordan? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I have Ali Al-Ahmad joining me here in the studio. He is a political analyst and director of the Saudi Institute. That's an institute which calls for reform and is based in Washington. It's nice to have you on the program. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us from Baghdad, Scott Peterson. He is a Christian Science Monitor reporter who's been reporting from that region now for more than a decade. Scott, it's good to have you as well.
Thank you.
Can I ask you, Scott, to just start off with this dramatic, what seems to be a fairly dramatic increase in bomb attacks that we've seen just over the last 2 weeks? What are people in Baghdad making of this?
Well, I think people have become really very, very inured to the fact that there's so much violence going on around them. I mean, I know that that many people feel that if something has blown up or exploded just literally one parallel street away, then that's actually far enough for them to feel safe and continue going on with their, you know, with their business of shopping for fruit or walking along the street or whatever they're doing. I mean, all of these attacks, despite the high numbers of casualties, and despite the random, complete apparent random nature of the violence, in terms of what they're targeting with convoys going by. Police targets obviously are a specific target, police stations and recruiting centers, but often these things can just go off along the street. It can be a car that's parked, a car that's driven. So people feel that if something goes off literally on a parallel street, then they feel that, you know, lightning hopefully won't strike twice, at least in the same hour. They'll go about their business and they'll finish it. But certainly it is having a psychological effect on people, and there's no doubt about that.
But are people looking at the increase in the effectiveness of the attacks and saying that that shows there's some kind of that the insurgents themselves are gaining strength?
Well, I think that what people see here is the wave of strikes and attacks that they were expecting to see at the end of January. Of course, that's when the election was, and there were incredible prophecies about how much damage was going to be done there, about how the insurgents would do everything possible to undermine and basically stop the election from going forward. And in fact, the election turned into this very positive, at least in the mind of many Iraqis, the majority, a positive statement against terrorism. But of course, in order to carry that momentum forward, what was necessary was to form a government that would begin to deal with and deal with this insurgency, and also begin to marshal that forward-looking momentum. Instead, what we've seen is political bickering for 3 months, which of course enabled the insurgents to regroup, get their, you know, and begin to get their stockpiles geared up and their recruits lined up, so that we see this type of wave of attacks.
And who are they saying the insurgents are? Are they saying they are Iraqis, they're locals, or they're foreigners?
Well, I think you very often, even to this day, despite how many suicide bombings there have been, which number in the hundreds, I think that most Iraqis still to this day say that this is not an Iraqi characteristic, that you don't find too many Iraqis themselves who are actually volunteering for martyrdom. So even though there's a large measure of the insurgency comes from former regime elements, intelligence and security people, Ba'athists, you know, and other secular elements, there's kind of a marriage of convenience at the moment, at least in terms of the primary aim, which is which is attacking Americans and making Iraq ungovernable, at least by this government. So you've got this kind of marriage of convenience that really seems to be playing itself out in a most vicious way at the moment.
Let me turn to Ali al-Ahmed here in the studio. This appears to match up with your research as well, that there is a significant amount of foreign influence in the latest attacks we're seeing from the insurgents?
I have seen all the tapes of the suicide the tapes that they have released on the internet, and most of those suicide bombers happens to be Saudis, Jordanians, Palestinians, some Syrians. I have not seen a single Iraqi on those suicide tapes.
These are tapes that are released in Baghdad by the government there. Is that
no,
right?
No, I'm talking about the tapes released by the Al-Qaeda organization.
Oh, okay. The people who are claiming to be the martyrs behind this, right?
Yes. This doesn't mean that there are not Iraqi terrorists or suicide bombers. There are, but I think the largest number of those suicide, you can call them suicide mules, really, because they are the one who are they come from the border of Syria or Jordan and told, you know, you're going to drive this car in a matter of days after they enter the Iraq. This is what they are told to do, to drive a car into some market or a hospital or a mosque, and they tend to be from those countries.
Why is it, though, Ali, that a young man from Syria or Saudi Arabia would sit behind the wheel of a car that's packed with explosives, and a young man from, say, the Anbar province, a young Sunni fighter, wouldn't be doing that? I mean, you're agreeing with Scott here that the suicide bombers are more likely to be people from outside, right?
Yes, I think it's easier for somebody from outside the country to do it. I think, number one, because of the ideological foundation that these young men have. In Saudi Arabia, for example, the top religious leaders, government and non-governmental, are installed in the hearts of these young Saudis or Jordanians that killing Shia or Kurds, or what they call them, Murtadin, apostates, is not only permissible, and it's more important than killing even the infidel Americans in their mind. So that is why it's easy. You see many times those people driving trucks into markets and
but
in
you're
hospitals.
Saying the inspiration for the bombers is to say to a young Sunni man, you're going to a place where you're going to kill a number of Shiite recruits or policemen, that sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely. It's religiously based. The suicide attacks are based on religious definition that we are the believers and they are the infidels, and it's okay for us to kill them in mass without distinction. And that's why you see also killing based on identity. If you are a Shia or a Kurds who are walking in the street doing nothing and you're captured by these terrorists, you'll be killed off just for the fact you are Shia or a Kurd.
Scott Peterson, back to you in Baghdad. Is that how people there are seeing it, that they are primarily attacks of the Sunni jihadists on Shiite people in Iraq?
Well, I think that they see the suicide attacks as working out that way. I mean, in other words, I think it's a combination of the two, in the sense that there's some infrastructure that is being provided by the, and some expertise also that is being provided by the former regime elements who really are quite capable. I mean, we know that from several different sources about the kind of training they had in urban warfare in creating these IEDs and roadside bombs and creating car bombs. I mean, Iraqi elements of the Iraqi security forces were as expert in those things as anybody. So that's one piece of expertise that fits into the puzzle. But then, as Ali says, you've also got really not a tradition of this kind of committing a suicide attack in the name of religion that you do with some of the other elements. I mean, be they Salafi or Wahhabi, but others, some of the more fundamental strains of Islam that are brought to bear here. I mean, I've spent in recent years quite a few hours, sometimes 6 or 7 or 8 hours, interviewing some of these people if they've been captured, and it's extraordinary the worldview that they put forward. And it's precisely as Ali says, their aim is to destroy as many infidels, be they Shia, Kurd, or Westerners, apostates, as possible. And as far as they're concerned, this is you know, this is their pathway to a better life, to the life that they believe that God has laid out for them, and that's why they do it. But they're not. I mean, my experience in Iraq is that you don't find so many Iraqis who are so enraptured by this kind of extreme ideology that lets them go that final step.
So the one part that leaves me confused, though, Ali, is that we will have a suicide bomb such as one earlier today in Tikrit. Now, that would be killing Sunnis, not Shiite.
Yes, now the sort of the disease of calling everybody else apostate now is not only limited against the Shia, all the Shia, but now it's coming to also to libel some of the Sunnis. It is at the latter stage, because I think if you start calling everybody apostate and their blood and wealth is permissible for you, then you tend also to start eating your own, and that's what happened. Some Sunnis chose to be with the new Iraq, with the new system, so they are libeled as traitors or apostate by those.
So possible signs that there are splits and divisions.
Absolutely.
Among the insurgents.
Absolutely.
Okay. Telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Your thoughts on this. Scott Peterson, I'll take this moment to thank you for being with us again on the program and ask you to keep your head down, okay?
Thank you very much.
Scott Peterson is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor, joining us there on the line from Baghdad. More voices, more thoughts when we come back after the break. We'd like to include you as we take a look at what seems to be an increase both in the number and perhaps the strength of the insurgency. What does it mean? What does it mean for the people in Iraq? And what does it mean for the policy of this country? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour. We're trying to take a closer look at the insurgency in Iraq to understand who the people are there and why it is they seem so determined to even attack Iraqis, not just Shiite, but Sunni, Kurds. These attacks that we have been watching over the past couple of weeks have been taking place in cities right across the country. And a reminder that here in the studio with me, I have Ali Al-Ahmed. He is a political analyst and director of the Saudi Institute based in Washington. And I should note that you happen to be in Boston because you're here to accept a Freedom to Write Award from Penn for a Saudi imprisoned poet. What's his name, the poet?
This is poet Ali Ad-Dumaini, who has been in prison since March of 2004 for his call for democracy in the country.
My understanding is that his call for democracy is not particularly threatening to the House of Saud.
Absolutely. In his memoirs from prison, that he said he's totally against terrorism and he does not want to overthrow the regime, and he has not called for any violence, but a peaceful call for expanding the level of freedom, speech and expression, involving the people in their own affairs and running their government, and calling for an establishment of a constitutional monarchy where everybody is equal under the law without distinction. And I want to thank Penn and New England for their leadership on this, because they are the first organization that has carried Mr. Domeini and heard his voice from behind the bars, and they are the first organization in the world that awarded him given him an award for his resilience and peaceful calls. And they are to be commended, and hopefully Faneuil Hall is the right place for that.
Let me ask you about some of the work that your own institute has done. You released a story very recently, comments from Saudi government minister, Chief Justice Sheikh Saleh Al-Luhaydan,
Luhaydan,
urging young Saudis to go to Iraq to fight. And you got this from a recording taken at a mosque, is that right?
Yes, this is basically was a recording that happened last year in October of Sheikh Saleh Al-Luhaydan, who is one of the two top religious leaders and also the chief justice. So he is in charge of prosecuting criminals or people who are terrorists and so on. This man, his position, his real belief is it's okay for Saudis, thousands of Saudis, to go to Iraq, to cross the border illegally. infiltrate and participate in creating more troubles for the Iraqis, and basically joining Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, who's
the Jordanian,
terrorist.
Does that mean, though, Ali, that it's government policy, the Saudi government policy?
Absolutely, it's a government policy. And if it was not government policy, this man should be punished. This is a dangerous statement, as one knows. And Mr. Luhaydan has not been reprimanded or removed from his job. Yet Mr. Ali Dumaini, who has done very,
the poet,
has been languishing in prison for over a year.
One more on this. I understand that the Saudi embassy in Washington has dismissed this as nonsense, as something that's being made up, this suggestion that the Saudi government is somehow backing the insurgency.
The NBC, with Lisa Myers, they did a wonderful job by calling the Luhaydan, and he admitted this was his voice and these are his words, but he wanted to interpret it some other way, and he said, I didn't mean it this way, I mean it that way. But of course it was too late. I think he meant it, and I can tell you, not only Mr. Luhaydan but other people in Saudi Arabia, the religious establishment especially, but also the political establishment, in secret they are. That's why you have thousands of Saudis going to Iraq. You don't see them going to another country because they allow it. And Mr. Na'mat, maybe who can tell you more about the fact that there is a place that they can go to, which is Israel, but in the past 50 years, the numbers of Arabs, Saudis or Jordanians who could not go into Israel because those governments made sure that no one infiltrated.
You're saying these Saudi young men would not be in Iraq if it wasn't something that was at least sanctioned by the
absolutely.
Government.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Salameh Namat, who has been listening in. He's joining us now on the line from Washington. Connection listeners will remember Salameh has been with us before. He is Washington Bureau Chief of Al-Hayat and the LBC, the Lebanon-based Arab Satellite Channel. Salameh, thanks so much for spending a moment with us.
You're welcome.
Your newspaper has been reporting recently that significant numbers of young Saudis have been in Iraq. What kind of numbers are we talking about here?
I'm not sure whether we have any official numbers on how many, but there are many people who are crossing the borders, not only from Saudi Arabia, but also from Syria, Jordan, and from Iran. And basically, while officially governments deny that they're allowing them, and while they say the opposite, that they're trying to prevent them from crossing or controlling their borders, they say it's very difficult to control these long borders, etc., etc. But I think that some of these governments would rather have these people, these jihadists, cross the borders and go and kill others and kill themselves rather than go and target the governments themselves. So I think there's a kind of undeclared deal where the intelligence services of some of these countries basically export these terrorists. First, they get rid of them. Second, they play a role in undermining the emerging democracy in Iraq so that the democracy virus doesn't spread in the region.
So is it their aim then to prolong the U.S. occupation? The more the suicide bombs, the more the U.S. is going to end up stuck in Iraq? Or is the U.S. military even a part of that equation?
Yes, basically, they're not necessarily wanting the Americans to leave now. They want first to abort the emergence. What's more important for them is to abort the emergence of a new Iraq. A government which can basically stand on its feet, that can control the situation. So that's why 9 out of 10 attacks are targeting Iraqis who are working to build Iraqi institutions that are supposed to replace the American occupation. So by doing that, they hope that eventually either the Americans are going to strike a deal with them at the expense of the current elected Iraqi government, or the Americans are going to get tired of it and leave, and then the government that stays behind is going to strike a deal with them, otherwise have to face instability for a long period of time. These people are working as part of a strategy. This strategy is backed by Arab countries. The fact that not a single Arab official has visited Baghdad yet to congratulate the Iraqis on electing their government or to offer any support, the fact that the Arab media is giving legitimacy to the criminal acts against innocent Iraqis is an indication that these countries do not want to see Iraq stable. They do not want to see the American democracy project work, anywhere in Iraq or elsewhere.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Your thoughts on what we're watching now with the insurgency in Iraq and a closer look at both the understanding and the identity of the people who are behind both the car bombs and the suicide bombs that are we're hearing about each day. Let's go to Danville, Virginia. James is joining us. Hello, James.
Yes.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, I was curious. There have been so many attacks on the Iraqi population, most of whom are Shiite, and since the core of the resistance is, at least in the Iraqis, is Sunni, I was wondering why, or perhaps that has already happened, that the Shiites wouldn't have a counterinsurgency against the Sunnis or counterterrorism against the Sunnis.
I mean, we've talked on the program before about the restraint that is imposed by the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani.
It's
precisely to try and avoid it becoming a civil war. But Ali, how long can the Shiite continue to absorb these kinds of attacks and maintain that restraint?
I only quote a friend of mine who was a religious cleric who just went back to Iraq, and I met him a few weeks ago, and he had visited with Sistani and asked him this question: how long can we take this? How long can we stay and wait, watch our children and young people being slaughtered this way? And Sistani said, forever. He said, what do you mean forever? He said, until the day of judgment. This is a strategy for Sistani, is to not to allow for sort of this vigilante justice, but he is insisting on organized justice, meaning through the government, and that has, according to the person my friend who met with him, this is his strategy.
And Salome, would that be because Sistani favors the idea of a genuinely elected Shiite government in Iraq, one that has the respect of other nations?
Well, yes, and also Sistani doesn't want to see Iraq plunged into a civil war. I mean, he could, if he unleashes the Shiites on the Sunnis, we're going to have a genocide. They can win if the Sunnis insist on a civil war, and if the Sunni leaders back these attacks, I am afraid we're going to be in a situation where the Shiites are going to basically wage a counter attack, whereby we're going to have thousands and thousands of people killed, and at the end the Shiites will win. You know, I know one Shiite who said before the elections, he said, whether by the bullet or by the ballot, we're going to win, win Iraq. We're going to gain power.
Ballot first choice, though.
Yes, ballot, of course, is the first choice. And that's why Sistani sticks to telling people, do not hit back. We do not want a civil war. He knows that if his back is to the wall, eventually, yes, they will go for it. And they will basically, we're going to have a purging of Sunnis in Iraq, which would be terrible. But obviously his choice is not to do that. He believes that it can be done without resorting to that kind of vigilante justice. And the bet is that eventually countries in the region, elements of the Saddam regime, the international Al-Qaeda-type jihadists, are going to give up and realize they cannot reverse the process in Iraq. They cannot, undermine the democracy project, and that they will start, becoming desperate and giving up at the end.
All right, let's go back to our callers. Where are we off to next? To Boston. And Ali's joining us from Boston. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask the question about Iran. Your first guest didn't mention anything about any of the elements, insurgencies coming from Iran, but your second guest mentioned. And I just, in addition to that, I wanted to add the issue of Shia versus Sunni. This is a very simplified version of looking at it. There are actually, Iran is a Shiite country, and I think it is to their benefit, to the benefit of the government of Iran, the current regime, to have this insurgency going, even though they're killing Shiites in Iraq, because it ensures America is bogged down in Iraq and it will never get to Iran. And basically, I want to hear your guest comment.
Yeah, I think this is partly true, but the Zarqawi group, you have the most active two groups in the country are the Zarqawi and Ansar al-Sunnah, and both of them are vehemently anti-Shia, anti-Iranian.
And the Zarqawi one, I know, that's the Jordanian. What was
Ansar
the other one?
Ansar al-Sunnah, which is okay. Operating in northern Iraq, and both of them are anti-Shia, absolutely, and they see all Shia to be murdered. There is has been in the West, in America, and there are accusation of Iran, over-exaggeration, because for political reasons. I mean, people who, for example, who are sympathetic with Israel, or even the Arab media, blamed Iran for the assassination of Ayatollah Hakim, who is the Shia leader, and others. So it was in their purpose. Both Iranian dissidents and pro-Israeli commentators in the U.S. and also the what I can call the Sunni Arab machinery all wanted to blame Iran for it. To get added benefits, killing the Shia and at the same time accusing Iran and shifting blame from their Sunni friends. The Zarqawi and the Arab governments, the Jordanians, especially the Jordanians. I want to focus on Jordan, because Jordan really has not been nobody paid attention to Jordan. Jordan has
well, Jordan and the U.S. have worked very closely together.
That's supposedly the way it is, but in reality, the matter reality. If you look at Jordan, if you send your reporters to Jordan, you will see that a lot of freedom for those Zarqawi networks to recruit and to celebrate, and the support of Zarqawi group in Jordan and other terrorists in Iraq is very open in the government. I want to make sure everybody knows that King Abdullah, for example, and Zarqawi share a lot of goals, but they do it differently. If you look at their statements in January and December. In December, Abdullah of Jordan said there is 1 million Iranian entered Iraq to inflate the number of Shia. Zarqawi in January said 4 million Iranians entered Iraq to inflate the numbers of Shia for the elections. And a year before, the Arab League, which is dominated by Sunni government, also said 2 million Iranians. The idea is not to win, not to allow Shia power to emerge in Iraq. That's one. Secondly, not to allow a democracy to emerge. And thirdly, a reliable source of oil, that will reduce the dependence of the Western countries on Saudi Arabia and in Iran. So, and will allow the oil export from Iraq will allow Shia entity in the Middle East to be strong and viable.
Let me turn to Salome. We will speak more on this program about the influence of Iran and does, you know, asking, is it in the interests of the Iranians to have an unstable country beside them? But, Salome, I do want your thoughts on what's the U.S. to do under current circumstances? Are the U.S. military leaders, in fact, getting sold a bill of goods by their advisors in Jordan? Do they need to take a harder look at the advice they're getting there? Do they need to be tougher with the Syrians and the Saudis?
I think they're beginning to get the message. They're beginning to realize that the double games and the duplicity of some of the regimes in the region, the problem is that their options are limited. They cannot basically escalate tensions with other countries in the region while they're unable to control the situation in Iraq. The problem is that for a long time, American policy in the region has been characterized by being naive, in the sense that, you know, some of these governments in the region are playing arsonists and firemen at the same time. And now I think relations are, you know, U.S.-Jordanian relations are cooling because of this, because of the feeling that Jordan is not doing enough to stop this flow of jihadists, etc. In some cases, you know, I have information, I cannot verify that, you know, there's some governments in the region are recruiting people from, you know, common criminals from prisons, some people on death row who are becoming suicide bombers in Iraq because they're dead anyway. They would be willing to go and do it in return for their families getting substantial amounts of money. Now, I cannot verify this, but this is, you know, I heard this in at least two sources in two different countries. And that's why increasingly the suicide bombers are coming from outside Iraq with the sources, you know, inside Iraq reduced dramatically. So, you know, the biggest suicide bombing of Al-Hilla last month was a Jordanian. 130 people were killed. The attack 2 weeks ago in Mosul, 50 people killed, was done by a Yemeni. And I think the U.S. has to realize that the regions, including countries that claim to be allies of the United States are fueling the saboteurs and the criminal elements in Iraq. They have no interest in seeing stability in Iraq. They want to see the undermining of the American project so that U.S. appetite is not encouraged to move forward.
Salameh, I've got to stop you there. We are out of time for this segment. And I thank you for being with us on the program.
Sure.
Salameh Nemat is Washington Bureau Chief of Al-Hayat Connection. Listeners, we know the risks that U.S. soldiers are facing in Iraq. It's a time that U.S. diplomacy got a little tougher on the outside here. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection, and this hour we're listening to some different perspectives on what the motivation is behind the insurgency in Iraq and the influence of foreign money and foreign fighters. We'd like to have you in on the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-TALK, and we're going to Canton, New York, for our next call. Michael's with us. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to state an opinion, make an observation.
Go ahead.
If I sound funny, it's because I'm home with a cold. I want to ask the question. I guess it's almost rhetorical. But what would we do if another country attacked us, bombed us to rubble, occupied us, killed our families, etc.? What would we, as defenders of our country, in that situation, be referred to as? Would be referred to as insurgents? How about radicals or
the resistance?
Yeah. You know, or how about terrorists or rebels? No, when they invaded us, the British here during the Revolution, they called us patriots when we fought back. The French helped us during the American Revolution. If they hadn't, we probably wouldn't have won. Americans hanged spies during the Revolution.
Your point is, Michael, that you wouldn't be, you're not surprised at all at the sort of level of the insurgency when you try to see it through the eyes of people who think that their country's been attacked.
Precisely. They're fighting in their hometowns. They're a sovereign nation that was invaded by the most powerful nation in the world. Their collateral damage, inclusive of grandparents, sisters, daughters, fathers, etc., they're numberless. Our dead are referred to as heroes. Theirs aren't even really referred to. We're running out of Iraqis to kill. You know,
Michael, you know, it's a great opportunity to use that point to introduce Molly Bingham on the program. She works as a photographer for the World Picture News Agency. She and the filmmaker Steve Connors, in fact, spent a considerable number of time interviewing the insurgents in the very early stages of the conflict. They're putting together a documentary on that, and Molly's been kind enough to send some of the photographs of the people that she spoke to. They are on our website. We're at theconnection.org. Molly's joining us on the phone. Hi there.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Fine. And thanks for joining us. The point that Michael is making here, I'm wondering how well it reflects some of the people that you talked to when you were doing your work last year.
Well, very well, and I was actually very glad to hear his voice pop up there. I think that the impression that we get here is that these are people who are unreasonable and what they're doing is absurd and they're terrorists, when I think Michael's really hit the nail on the head. From their perspective, their country's been invaded by, by America, by coalition forces of non-Muslims. They see it as absolutely their right and their duty to defend their country against this occupation.
Well, while some of them are doing that quite clearly, Molly, there are a considerable number of attacks against other Iraqis. That's the part that's hard to square here.
Well, I'd also like to bring in, there's some little research I was doing last night. There's a document that was put out by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It was put together by Anthony Cordesman last December. And what he did is count the number of attacks between September 2003 and October 2004. And he characterized who was the target of each of those attacks. Now, far and beyond, the hugest percentage is against coalition forces. Now, those are attacks against coalition forces. That's 75% of them are against coalition forces, while 4.1% are against civilians. Now, the difference is made up by attacks on police, Iraqi army, their local authorities or public property or contractors. So I think that this sense that certainly was happening in the earlier part of this conversation, that the vast number of these attacks are against civilians, is really statistically just not supportable. Now, obviously, the higher number of casualties will come from when civilians are attacked or when civilians are in the area of an attack, because obviously they have no physical body protection and they're much more vulnerable to this kind of violence.
I actually remember the release of that, and a lot of it had to do with you know, people who were just shooting at the convoys as they moved through various neighborhoods of Iraqi cities. Ali Al-Ahmed, I'm interested in your thoughts here. How do you fit together the idea that there has to be some Iraqi patriotism behind the insurgency with these people who are, as you say, coming in across the borders with entirely different agendas?
I think we're talking about impact more than frequency. And yes, there are some Iraqis who are fighting for, you know, or against the occupation. But I'm talking about the impact of the operation. It has been those who, with the agenda of killing as many people as they can, disrupting life and not allowing an emergence of stability in the country. There is an alliance between the former Saddamis, the Saddami supporters, and those foreign elements or Arab elements who came through the borders with the support of the Arab government, who do not want to see a new Iraq emerge. And so far, it has been hard because the U.S. has listened to the wrong people. I think they should listen to the people in Iraq, not to the Jordanians or the Saudis or the Syrians or so on, or the Egyptians, who really have no interest in making Iraq stable. So far, for example, the Jordanians are the biggest benefit of the reconstruction work. It's the Jordanian business and Jordanian economy that has improved. It's not the Iraqi. I think that is important. Listen to the Iraqis.
Okay, but Molly, the people that you interviewed, the people who you spent time with, would they be quite happy to pledge allegiance to a new Iraqi government?
Well, what happened, what I did is I went into a very small neighborhood of Baghdad with Steve Connors and I. We did this reporting together. And we tried to talk to as many different people as we could. We ended up interviewing 15 people in depth, and we took 7 of those and followed them and interviewed them repeatedly over a period of 10 months. And what we found is that, first of all, these people started fighting immediately after the war ended, within the first week after the ground war ended. And so it was not an issue of losing the peace over the summer. That helped them recruit people. But
these are former Baathists, former soldiers. Who were you talking to?
Well, very few of them were. One of them had been in the Ba'ath Party, or actually two of them had been in the Ba'ath Party. One of them had been a former soldier. They were people from all walks of life. But what I want to get onto is that their initial, in the early conversations that we had with them in August, September, October of 2003, there was this very strong nationalist, you know, defending the country for our country, how mm-hmm. dare they come here, this sort of language. And that after the capture of Saddam, one of the things that we began to understand, and I think had been probably going on before we understood it, was this transition, this sort of how Islam had come in and sort of co-opted the nationalists. Because in Islam, the mandatory jihad is called for when your country is invaded by non-Muslims. And I think that Islam ended up incorporating the nationalists into that, and hence the movement has become more Islamic and more Islamically founded. And I think that's part of what we're seeing. And we're talking about people coming in from around the Arab world or further afield to fight in that jihad, to fight in that Islamic movement. And I think that that's sort of part of the transition that's gone on. So I think there are a lot of things. Yes, there are Ba'athis. Yes, there are former military elements. Yes, there are common, normal people, truck drivers, bus drivers, you know, mechanics, people who are involved, who are holding down day jobs while they're doing this. Yes, there are foreigners. But I'd also quote, you know, Doug Gell from the New York Times on January 8th of this year. He quoted a Pentagon official of saying, of the roughly 8,500 prisoners that they have held who are suspected insurgents, 325 of them are non-Iraqis. So that's not a huge majority. And I think that it's the other thing that I think is really...
Molly, I'm going to have to let you go. I'm sorry. Okay. We've got a bunch of people who want to join us on the phone.
Good.
So I thank you for being with us. Molly Bingham, photographer for World Picture News Agency, who's busy working on a film in which they did some considerable time interviewing insurgents in Iraq. 1-800-423-8255 to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Mike's on the line. Hello, Mike.
Hello, and thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah.
I wanted to add a couple of points of experience I might have gained. I spent almost 14 months in Iraq from the start of the war. I'm a former Marine. And while I was there, I spent most of my time in Baghdad at first and then down in Karbala. And I managed to pick up some of the language. And I made some friends who I still keep in contact with. And I ask them questions all the time about the insurgency and how are things at home and how's the safety situation. And what my friend in Karbala, he feels that many of the insurgents are Iraqis themselves. And he didn't want to quote any sources or say why he believed that. But that thought was echoed by my friend in Baghdad, who he felt that many people in Baghdad, regular civilians, they felt pressure. Like there was three kinds of civilians. There were those who they wanted the strong government. They appreciate the support of the Americans. They want to make a strong Iraq. There's those on the other side that want the Americans out. They feel an identity. They have an understanding and common ground with insurgents, or they fear being attacked and killed by insurgents, so they're pressured into siding with them anyways. And then there's those, like my friend, who are just in the middle. They're trying to live their life, and a lot of them have purchased handguns and rifles, even illegally, that they keep and walk around with.
Mike, I'm wondering if there's any word from them about the amount of money that has come in, because one of the parts that we haven't spoken about yet on the program directly is you know, how there is apparently a lot of financing coming in, particularly from Saudi Arabia, and in part that's providing a kind of twisted form of employment for Iraqis, former soldiers, other people who can't get jobs in such a sort of upset economy.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, I can't speak too intelligently about it because it's not something that I've really discussed in depth with my friends.
Yeah.
But one other point that I would like to add regarding Iraqis killing Iraqis is that it's my opinion, based on talking to my two friends, that Iraq is divided on much more than religious grounds. There's, of course, Sunnis and Shiites, but I feel like Iraq is also divided strongly on tribal along tribal lines, because when I asked my friend in Baghdad about attacks that were happening in Karbala and Najaf, he really couldn't care. You know, he just, you know, whatever. And when I asked my friend in Karbala about what was going on in Mosul, he also couldn't care. Both of them echoed the same kind of opinion. Oh, that's Mosul. Oh, that's Najaf. You know, that's...
No, I mean, you know what?
Those are different people.
It's a really good reminder, Mike and Ali. One of our earlier callers made the point, and I think it quite legitimate, that there's a risk here in oversimplifying what we're seeing in Iraq, in saying, that, oh, well, it's just Sunni against Shia, or it's foreigners versus Iraq. Because it is some of that and all of everything else, and very hard in some ways to try and pick it apart.
I think you're right here, but also we don't want to lose focus of the important, the central issues. There are, of course, in all the regions of the world, there are some tribal divisions or regional divisions and so on. But you see Iraqis care about what happens in Hala, majority of them, what happens if there's a bombing in Karbala. They do care. They don't not care. But the overriding differences now is becoming religious or sectarian, because we used to have an Iraq dominated by the minority Sunni Arabs over the majority Shia and the Kurds. Now it is the reverse. So you expect naturally those who used to be in power and to be the masters and the others to be the slaves. Now it's reversed and everybody's equal. Of course they were resisted, and they are using the neighboring countries, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, the official and the popular, for support and money and fighters.
Let's go back to our callers, to Cambridge. John's on the line. Hello, John.
Hi, Gordon. The question is, you know, since the crux of the problem is those foreign infiltrators, like the Iraq and Turkey, whatever, the Iraq has the borders, why, I understand there's like old saying says, my enemy's enemy, my best friend. To my understanding, some of those countries, I think, the development in Iraq, if goes like negatively so far, is sort of like a very productive for them, for their interests. And is it very difficult to seal those countries' borders with Iraq? Why, I mean, the United States and also the Iraqi government They don't do anything about this.
I know that the U.S. Marines are currently in quite a considerable operation now on the western border of Iraq, between Iraq and Syria. I don't know, though, Ali, if the Iraqi security forces, such as they are, and the U.S. military said, this has really got to be our priority. We need to close these borders. Could they?
I think they can. You see, like we said earlier, that the border of Israel, for example, has been very solid in the past 50 years because the neighboring countries,
it's Syrians, a lot smaller country, though.
Absolutely, but there are also a lot of people who would like to join the Syrians, the Egyptians, the Jordanians. The Jordanians have the longest border with Israel. They make sure nobody gets through because they know if somebody gets through, there'll be repercussions. And I think the U.S. must send that message. If we see a single Saudi or a single Jordanian, it is the government of Jordan, it's the government of Saudi Arabia that will pay the repercussion. So far, they have not been asked to pay a price or to a question. Nobody, for example, asked why. Nobody yet even mentioned it in the media that the king of Jordan is the one who signed or released Zarqawi from prison few weeks after he took power. Nobody even talks about it.
Okay,
he never apologized for this action.
Talk about what we see in this country. Just a matter of days ago, President Bush, yes, holding hands with Crown Prince Abdul of Saudi Arabia. I mean, so even if there is money and even if there is religious encouragement for young Saudis to go to Iraq, I mean, can you see this country actually getting tough with the Saudis, as dependent as the U.S. is on Saudi oil?
I think it's supposed to be easier to be tough with your friends, to be direct with your friends than your enemy. It's very hard to pressure the Iranians because you don't have a relationship with them, but it's easier to do it with the Saudis and the Jordanians, because Jordan especially, it depends on the U.S. for everything. So it's easier to squeeze those two countries. You can squeeze China, which is much bigger, with larger economic ties with the U.S., but why not Saudi Arabia? Why not? Especially that they are killing your soldiers. I would say that one thing is, number-wise, the largest number of Americans killed by terrorists after September 11 were killed by Saudi suicide bombers in Iraq. So let's have some kind of policy to say, well, Saudi Arabia, you will be held accountable. Those who call for, like Sheikh Luhaidan and others who call for terrorism in Iraq, should be punished too.
Ali, I thank you so much for coming in. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Ali Al-Ahmed is political analyst and director of the Saudi Institute. It is an institute that calls for reform, based in Washington. He happens to be in Boston to accept the Penn New England's Freedom to Write Award for the imprisoned Saudi poet Ali Al-Dumaini. Did I say that right? Dumaini?
Okay. In Faneuil Hall.
All right. Earlier in the hour, we had a chance to talk with Scott Peterson, Christian Science Monitor reporter who is in Baghdad, Salameh Namat, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Hayat News, and Molly Bingham, photographer with the World Picture News Agencies. And just a reminder for links to the videos and the interviews and some of the images that Molly Bingham has brought back from Iraq, you can go to our website. We are at theconnection.org. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.